Welcome to Shouts from the Back Row, the official podcast of the-back-row.com. My name is Gil, and I'm your host, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Robin.
Hello!
I'm excited, man. We've been wanting to talk about this topic for a while now on the podcast, but TK has never been interested in it. So, although his absence from this program is unfortunate, there's a silver lining. We're going to be discussing movies starring wrestlers. If you're only tuning in for the first time, or you haven't read any of Robin's articles on the Back Row, then I should preface this discussion by saying that Robin is the Back Row's resident wrestling writer. He's written numerous articles on it, done a bunch of Before They Were Stars features on wrestlers, and has an apartment that's just full of wrestling posters. So, you know that we have an expert present for this discussion. So, grease yourself up and squeeze into that leotard. It's time to talk about wrestlers and their often ill-fated film careers. Are you ready for this podcast? Because Bonesaw is ready!
Yeah!
But first, a few messages. The Back Row has a PayPal account, and we're accepting donations. If you feel like throwing some of your hard-earned dollars our way, you can do so at the Back Row. Just go to the-back-row.com and click the Donate button in the right column. If you donate, you can choose a movie for us to review and even specify which of us gets to review it. Doesn't that sound like fun? So send us your dollars and we'll review your favorite wrestling movie. Shouts from the Back Row is available through iTunes. If you search the iTunes store for the Back Row podcasts, you can subscribe to our feed, which will not only get you your weekly dose of media culture from us, but also Tom Lando's all-original audiobook podcast series, Oathbreakers, and back episodes of our heavy metal podcast, Drop D Revolution, and our surreality podcast, The Tom Lando Files. Tell your friends, and subscribe today. We like to open the show with a discussion of what we've been up to. This is a place for us to talk about movies we've been watching, TV shows we've been following, games we've been playing, it's just about everything else we've been doing. So, Robin, what have you been up to?
Well, I finally got a chance to see Sam Raimi's Oz the Great and Powerful, and I was pretty lukewarm about this film. Like, I kind of figured it might be kind of like Tim Burton's version of Alice in Wonderland, just very bland and forgettable and not very involving, but I actually like this a lot more than I thought I would. I had a pretty fun time watching it. This is not like a groundbreaking family film by any stretch of the imagination. Like, it doesn't have any real surprises, and because it's a prequel, it doesn't have a lot of suspense. You kind of know what's going to happen to all these characters, but it's a good way to spend 2 hours. I think Raimi does a good job handling the material. This is a very good-looking film. He does a very effective job at creating, like, the new Oz world. I kind of like how he shoots, like, the first 20-25 minutes in black and white in the 4.3 aspect ratio, just like the old Wizard of Oz, and then once they get to Oz, it becomes widescreen again and all colorful. And the big surprise here was James Franco in the role of the Wizard. Like, I've never been a big fan of his. I liked him in 127 Hours, and I think Pineapple Express, but he's always been kind of bland in other movies I've seen him, but he does a surprisingly good job here. He's very engaging and likable, playing like a character who's kind of a con artist at first, but still has a good heart, and eventually, like, wins the people over that he's dealing with. And I liked a lot of the CGI characters in this as well. He has two sidekicks, a monkey named Finley, played voiced by Zach Braff, and a little China doll type character who's surprisingly effective as well. Even though they're all CGI, they look very convincing and they don't become annoying at all. And yeah, it's just a very good time overall. And of course, there's an obligatory Bruce Campbell cameo. When the movie started, I was kind of thinking, man, this would probably be awesome if they had cast Bruce Campbell as the Wizard. But James Franco wound up winning me over, I must say. So yeah, even though I was not looking forward to this film, I had an enjoyable time watching it, and I would recommend it, and would actually look forward to more Sam Raimi Oz films.
Did you see this in 3D?
No, I didn't, actually, but it looked really good in 2D, I must say.
So I saw Oz the Great and Powerful as well, and I actually had sort of the opposite reaction to a lot of the points that that you enjoyed. I found James Franco not particularly engaging as the wizard, although I did like sort of his big moment during the climactic battle. I thought that was a pretty clever moment. But overall, my reaction was very similar to Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland, except I should say that I prefer Oz the Great and Powerful over Wonderland simply because there's no pop and lock dance number from a Mad Hatter in Oz the Great and Powerful. But the witches, the three witches, played by Mila Kunis, Rachel Weisz, and Michelle Williams, I found them to all be just sort of fawning bimbos throughout most of the movie. I didn't really dig the makeup they put on Mila Kunis when she becomes the evil witch. But it's funny because as I was watching this, I thought, and I should say, I hated the two CGI sidekick characters.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I really didn't like either of them. I found them both annoying and completely unnecessary to the movie. But there were moments that I really did like. As I said, I'll say minor spoilers, but this is something that's in The Wizard of Oz. When the wizard's face is on the big cloud of smoke near the end of the movie, I thought that moment was used really effectively. And throughout it, I was like, I feel like I should like this. And then it hit me. Robin, Oz the Great and Powerful is just a remake of Army of Darkness.
Yeah, that is kind of true. Yeah.
Think about it. Think about it. A wisecracking, arrogant womanizer is swept off to a fantasy land. When he lands there, he's hailed as the prophesied hero who's going to deliver the land from evil. And so he uses modern technology and trickery to win the final battle. And over the course of this whole movie, his love interest gets, like, possessed by some evil thing and becomes this hideous monster.
That is blown my mind. I never even thought of that before.
It occurred to me when they were doing the montage where the wizard is, like, getting out all his modern tricks for the final battle. And I was like, wait a minute. Especially where, again, spoilers, he's instructing people on how to build fireworks. It's like, that seems really familiar. Oh, my God. It's just Army of Darkness all over again, but for the family crowd. I don't know. I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. But the parts that were Army of Darkness, I really enjoyed.
But another cool thing about it is I read in the end credits that pretty much half the cast of the original Evil Dead has cameos in this, because I think it's Ellen Sanweiss and Betsy Baker have roles as the villagers in Oz, so I thought that was kind of cool as well. And I did see this with an audience of a lot of kids, and they seemed to like it quite a bit, so that can kind of rub off on you. But it's not one of my favorite Sam Raimi films, but I got to say I still liked it overall.
Fair enough, fair enough.
Okay. So what else I've been seeing is I finally got a chance to watch John Dies at the End. And, of course, this is based on the novel by David Wong, the senior editor at Crack.com. And the guy is practically my part-time boss now, because he has personally gone over and approved a lot of the pitches that I've handed in that have become articles. So I am kind of ashamed to admit that I still have yet to read the actual novel. I will get around to it someday, but I thought I would check out the movie. And I kind of wish I had read the novel before I watched the movie, because I was pretty lost during a lot of parts of this. Like, there was a lot of engaging visual stuff in this, a lot of cool ideas, a lot of clever, memorable scenes, but I feel I would have gotten a lot more out of this film if I had read the novel first. I mean, a lot of the word of mouth when they originally announced that this was going to be made into a movie was that the novel was, like, practically unfilmable. I know a lot of people are satisfied with this adaptation of the novel, but I heard a lot of people say that because a lot of good stuff from the novel was cut out. I don't know if that's a problem. That's why I couldn't follow it, because this is just one of those movies where I'm never bored during it. I'm always interested, but I just can't find myself getting engaged, because I'll see, like, it'll just kind of jump from random cool scene to random cool scene, but I just don't, because I don't have an inkling of what's going on, I just can't really get involved in it. I like the direction.
Sorry to interrupt. This is really interesting for me to hear, because I read the book before I saw the movie, and therefore I just don't have the same perspective that you do. You say you didn't really understand what was going on in the movie. Can you give us just your interpretation of the plot?
Oh, God. I don't even know how to summarize it. That's the problem. I just know it's about David and John, and David suffers some after effects of eating some soy sauce and stuff, and they go into another dimension, and John apparently dies, but he's contacting David from another dimension, and God, I couldn't even summarize this. That's what I was saying, is it kind of jumps from one scene to another, but I couldn't really, like, explain what's going on, even while I was enjoying it. But overall, like, it actually compelled me to go back and read the novel, but I don't think I will watch this one again until I've read it, because it's one of those films, it's really out there, and it's one of those films you probably have to watch a couple times to interpret what's going on. But it does have some cool stuff in it, and I'm really happy to see it was directed by Don Coscarelli. And even though the special effects in this are, like, really bad, that is part of the movie's charm. So it is worthwhile, but it's just something very different.
I was a big fan of John Dies at the End, both the book and the movie. There are massive things cut out of the movie that were, you know, part of the book, but that didn't bother me at all. I don't know. I guess the best way to describe it is it's sort of like an acid trip, R-rated version of Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, like that kind of bizarreness, where the soy sauce isn't literally soy sauce. It's this weird drug that they're taking, the street name of which is soy sauce. And they both suffer these weird side effects where they can, like, see into other dimensions, and they can see supernatural things going on all around them. And then they just have these wacky adventures and eventually end up in this weird sort of alternate, almost hell-like dimension. If that explains any of it, I mean, it is very strange. The charm of the book is definitely in the narrative voice. David Wong's narrative voice is really funny and really clever and fun. And that's probably the strongest point about the book, which it's something that the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movie also suffered from.
Yeah, it's like, it sounds like it's one of those books that plays really well on paper because of the narrative voice, but doesn't always translate well to film. And as a cheap plug, I'm going to make an appropriate transition here and also mention that I've just recently got two more articles accepted by Crack.com this morning, and that I'm going to have a couple more finally posted up on the website within the next few days or so. So even though I may not have appreciated John Dies at the End, David Wong still rules.
Fair enough.
Yep. And yeah, that's about all I've been up to.
Well, other than Oz the Great and Powerful, I've been up to a lot. We've been working on some interesting projects that will come to fruition in the near future. But I haven't been taking in a lot of new media. So I thought it might be fun. A bunch of new trailers dropped recently. I thought it might be fun for us to talk about those trailers a bit. Did you have a chance, Robin, to watch all of them?
Not yet. No, I only got to watch one, Trance.
Oh, so you haven't seen the trailer for Kick-Ass 2 yet?
No, I haven't. Not
oh,
even
my
in
goodness.
Years.
Are you looking forward to Kick-Ass 2 at all, Robin? Did you enjoy the first one?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It was one of my favorite movies that came out that particular year, so I definitely look forward to seeing the next one, especially with Jim Carrey in it. I'm anxious to see how that's going to work out.
Yeah, his performance looks really great from the trailer. He's unrecognizable. Caitlin didn't recognize him at all. But it looks like a lot of fun. Kick-Ass struck such an interesting note in terms of its tone, creating this, like, hyper-violent but also, like, Kid Rock sort of, not Kid Rock the artist, but, like, Kids Rule sort of attitude, particularly with the character of Hit Girl, but also Dave Lazowski, Kick-Ass. You know, he's this nerdy high school kid, and he just decides to become a superhero, and it all has a very sort of upbeat and colorful and cheerful tone to it, which is contrasted by this extreme violence. Looks like Kick-Ass 2 is more of the same. I can't wait to see Christopher Mintz-Plasse's return. He was Red Mist in the first one, and he's taken on the persona of a supervillain called Motherfucker in Kick-Ass 2, and his costume just looks totally insane. So yeah, this looks like Kick-Ass, but, you know, turned up to 11. Hopefully this is going to be like to Kick-Ass what The Dark Knight was to Batman Begins, and be that great second installment that just turns everything up and does everything right.
I'm just glad that they are doing a sequel, because I know the first one was, it was kind of a modest hit, but it wasn't a blockbuster, so I'm happy that they're making more of them.
Yeah, it's true. I'm really thrilled about this as well. Here's hoping it's good. It's too bad that Matthew Vaughn isn't returning as director. There's a new trailer out. It's a Japanese trailer, I believe, for The Lone Ranger. This is basically another one of the, it follows the same structure as a lot of the other Lone Ranger trailers, except in this one you get to see that Helena Bonham Carter's character has a cannon for a leg. Robin, did you ever watch The Lone Ranger? I've never watched the TV series The Lone Ranger.
Not at all, no. Like, I've seen the American trailers for the Lone Ranger movie, but not this Japanese version. I had no idea that Helena Bonham Carter had a cannon for a leg.
Yeah, so I'm really curious. I don't think that it really doesn't sound like that's something from the Lone Ranger. But who knows, maybe a fan. If there are any fans out there, they could write in. I don't know. It looks like a lot of fun. What are your opinions on the Lone Ranger, Robin?
I don't know. I remember watching it and thinking, this totally resembles, excuse me, a Tim Burton movie, because it's got, like, Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter, and it kind of has kind of the same whimsical, like, style to it. But I don't know. I mean, I could develop more of an opinion for it if I really knew more about The Lone Ranger, but, I mean, it's such an old property that I'm not familiar with it, and I don't know how big of an audience there's going to be for it. But then again, like, I pretty much thought the same thing about Pirates of the Caribbean from Gore Verbinski, and look what a big hit it turned out to be. So I guess it could potentially work out. I am happy, though, to see Armie Hammer in, like, a lead role, because I always loved him as the Winklevoss twins in The Social Network. So I hope this kind of propels him up to stardom as well.
Yeah, I really liked him in The Social Network as well, and I hope that he takes – I saw the movie Mirror, Mirror, which was pretty bad, but he was at least kind of fun in it. I don't know. I've written a lot about this on the back row, how I just really don't know how to feel about the Lone Ranger. Johnny Depp back with Gore Verbinski. It looks a lot like Pirates of the Caribbean in terms of just like the visual look of the movie, the saturated colors and such. And that could be a lot of fun as long as it closely resembles the first Pirates of the Caribbean and none of its sequels. But, I don't know. I hesitate to get too invested in it, and there is this strange sort of racial issue about the character of Tonto. I mean, I guess he's part of popular culture, but I don't know. It all seems very awkward, and it feels like the kind of movie that I'm going to watch and probably really enjoy, but feel like I can't really admit it because of that sort of thing. It is a shame, but I don't know. All that being said, I am going to watch it one way or another. Robin, have you had a chance to see the latest trailer for Star Trek Into Darkness?
No, I haven't.
It looks fun. Did you go to the Hobbit screenings that had the 10-minute preview of the first 10 minutes of the movie for them?
Oh, no, I didn't. So, no, I haven't seen it.
Oh, okay. So I got to see the first 10 minutes. I got to see this trailer, and it's really good. The marketing team is putting a lot of shots that are from those first 10 minutes in their trailers. So a lot of this movie has yet to be spoiled by the marketing campaign, which I really appreciate. I think this looks like a lot of fun. Again, you know, it's another big sequel, and much like Kick-Ass 2, I'm hoping it's one of those sequels that's even better than the first one. As rare as they seem to be. But at least in this case, it's entirely the same cast and crew getting back together with J.J. Abrams at the helm. And hopefully this means we'll get a well-rounded and quite good new Star Trek trilogy out of it.
I'm actually surprised it took them 4 years to finally get this out, considering what a big hit the original film was.
Yeah, no kidding. I suppose all the cast members had, or cast and crew probably had other things they needed to do. Like, I know Simon Pegg was filming The World's End. And finally, this comes out soon, and it seems like not a lot of people are making that much of a big deal about it, but I think it looks great. The Danny Boyle film Trance, starring James McAvoy and Vincent Cassel, and Rosario Dawson. It's the story of a guy, I guess, a thief who steals a painting, and the evil people who want it back, hypnotize him in order to find out where he's hidden it. From that premise, it sounds like it could be really cheesy. And the first trailer for Trance, it looked interesting, but I wasn't sure about it. But then this Red Band trailer dropped, and now I'm hooked. This looks really cool and almost David Cronenberg-like, with a few of its twists and turns. And Robin, you said you had a chance to watch this one, right?
Yeah, I really didn't know a lot about this movie until I watched this trailer, but it is quite an interesting premise, and it was kind of trippy looking. Like, it sounds like it's a premise that could go horribly, horribly bad, but I have confidence that Danny Boyle will be able to do it. And it's also, I think it's being written by John Hodge, who also wrote the screenplays for his other films like Trainspotting and Shallow Grave. So I have confidence they're going to turn this into something interesting.
Yeah, it should be a great time, I think. I can't remember. I don't think I put this in my most anticipated movies of the year. I maybe gave it an honorable mention somewhere, but yeah, it's shooting right up there. It's coming out soon, and I can't wait to see this one. So let's get into our discussion of the movie careers of wrestlers. And this topic actually has a few connections to current events, not the least of which is the death of William Moody, better known as Paul Bearer, the wrestling manager for The Undertaker. But we've also got a movie coming out that stars a former pro wrestler, the movie being G.I. Joe Retaliation, and the wrestler being Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And you know, we didn't plan any of that, which should give you some idea of how influential wrestling is on popular culture. So Robin, you're a huge fan of wrestling. How did that start? Where did your love of wrestling come from?
Well, like a lot of people in my generation, I started in like the late 1980s when the whole rock and wrestling connection started and like Hulk Hogan was on top of the world. It all started with like WrestleMania in like 1985 where wrestling had gotten like totally mainstream unlike anything they'd ever seen before, where they did crossovers where they got like Cyndi Lauper to appear at WrestleMania and they'd have wrestlers appear like in music videos and you'd have like Hulk Hogan hosting Saturday Night Live. Like wrestling was kind of like an underground thing before that with a cult following, but this was the first time it had ever like gone completely mainstream and like turned like wrestlers into full-fledged celebrities and stuff. And that's the way it is today. And I've been watching it like ever since. As during some phases I've been more interested in it than the others, but I continue to at least follow it today. Wrestling has become such a different industry now because of the invention of the internet. So now you can check up on like all the behind the scenes stuff going on in the industry, whereas back in the old days, everyone pretended that it was all real. So if like a guy, say, left the wrestling promotion, you would never find out about it because they wouldn't acknowledge it on TV. So you couldn't really follow what was going on. But now it's just so much more mainstream that it's a totally different animal.
I too was actually a bit of a wrestling fan as a child of the 80s, as a boy growing up in the 80s. Of course, wrestling was everywhere in popular culture, and I remember there were stickers that my dad would collect for me. I think it was a particular brand of potato chips gave away like wrestling stickers, and he collected a whole bunch for me, and that was my introduction to a lot of these characters. And then, he bought me some wrestling action figures, and I saw some movies starring wrestlers. The ones I saw as a kid, none of them were particularly good, as I recall. And on top of that, I also watched like the Super Mario Brothers Super Show, which had Lou Albano as the host, right? And so I was definitely a fan when I was a kid, but it's not something that I kept up with. I should also note that the connection to G.I. Joe has been an ongoing one. Because was it Sergeant Slaughter? He was a wrestler, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. Like, he actually started off as a wrestler for years, but then signed a contract with G.I. Joe to use his likeness and image in the cartoons and for toy lines, and then he came back to wrestling. And actually, he became an Iraqi sympathizer during the early 90s. He turned into a bad guy and drummed up a lot of heat. And he still makes the occasional cameo appearance on wrestling shows today, and I was just so disappointed that he did not get a cameo appearance in the first G.I. Joe movie, because it's like, you actually have one G.I. Joe character who's a real-life person and you don't use him? Come on.
I hadn't thought about that. It is a shame that he wasn't included. With that sort of out of the way, talking about our backgrounds with wrestling, Robin is clearly the expert here because I have no idea anything about recent wrestling stuff. All my knowledge sort of ends with, the Ultimate Warrior or the Million Dollar Man back in the 1980s. So let's talk about the movie careers of wrestlers, and we're going to be doing our favorite, but also the worst. And before we get to our top three best movies starring wrestlers, did you have any additional criteria, Robin, when you were constructing your list?
I guess my only rule was that I wasn't going to use documentaries, because I've talked a lot on previous podcasts about documentaries like Beyond the Mat about the wrestling industry. But this is basic, and I'm pretty much going to stay away from Mickey Rourke's The Wrestler, because I've talked about it a lot and it doesn't really star any wrestlers. I'm mainly just going to focus on acting roles that wrestlers appeared in.
I actually, this was sort of tough. I guess I'll say this, that there aren't a lot of really good movies starring wrestlers, with wrestlers in the leading role, but I wanted to challenge myself and actually have three movies where the wrestler character, or the actor who was a wrestler, their character was really prominent, and at least have one where they are the main character, and it's a movie that I legitimately find to be a really great film. So those were my criteria. So, Robin, what's your number three?
Well, my number three I chose mainly just because it's so unexpected, because this is one of the all-time greatest movies of all time, and it stars a wrestler in a very prominent role, and that's The Godfather. And I ask you, Gil, do you know which character I'm talking about?
Why, it's Luca Brasi, of course, right?
Yes, Luca Brasi. A lot of people don't know that the actor who played him, Lenny Montana, was a very successful and popular wrestler during the 1950s and 60s. He started off wrestling, I think, as under the name the Zebra Kid, and then he became like just started wrestling under his real name, Lenny Montana, and he won a lot of tag team titles. Like, he teamed up with some very big names from the time period, like Vern Gagne and Eddie Graham and stuff. So I was surprised when I looked at his background and saw that he'd worked for a lot of big promotions and won a lot of major titles. But when he finally retired from wrestling, he rumoredly got involved with organized crime. Like, he became a bodyguard for like a lot of reputed mobsters, and that's kind of how he got the role in The Godfather. And it's such a cool, iconic role. It's a very famous story how he was just had no acting experience and was just like so nervous and had trouble getting his lines out that he would like recite them over and over again, because his very first scene he was going to be shooting with like Marlon Brando. So Francis Ford Coppola actually decided to put that footage in the movie, because you can see a scene of Luca Brasi rehearsing over and over again, "I am honored to meet you on the day of your daughter's wedding," and they talk about how it totally enhances the character of Don Corleone, where this like big tough guy is so intimidated and nervous talking to him and stuff, and it shows how much influence the Don has. So even though this isn't a role that requires like a lot of like any big acting, it's a good showcase for Lenny Montana, because his acting is so natural. He really is like very nervous when meeting the Don in the scene, and he does well in the scene. He doesn't have a lot of dialogue, but he is like a very like tough, brutal force and a very memorable screen presence before he gets killed off. And Lenny Montana actually went on to have a pretty successful film career. He mostly appeared in gangster roles, of course. I think he actually played a gangster in the Jackie Chan film, The Big Brawl, I think it was. So he did pretty well for himself. And oh, yeah, and he was also in Steve Martin's The Jerk. I think he was a gangster in that, too. So this is, yeah, just basically a guy who found a successful career as an actor just basically on his look, because he was a tough, intimidating looking man, and he wound up appearing in one of the greatest films of all time. So I think it's just really cool that The Godfather has a wrestling connection, because a lot of people never would have guessed that.
It's also a really sort of funny and endearing wrestling connection.
Yeah.
Because it's not the kind of role, I mean, it is the kind of role that you would expect to see a wrestler in, but it's not the kind of performance that you'd expect to see them give. And like you said, it just enhances the character of the Don, because even a pro wrestler cowers in fear before the screen presence of Marlon Brando. So my number three, I'm willing to bet this movie is going to turn up on your list somewhere. Well, let's see. I'll quiz you. I'm here to chew bubblegum and to kick ass. I'm all out of bubblegum.
Gee, you chose my number one. What a surprise.
At my number three, They Live, the awesome John Carpenter movie starring Rowdy Roddy Piper. And there are a number of just awesome things about They Live. First off, all the John Carpenter stuff. You know, John Carpenter, he does this ridiculous but awesome story about the aliens that have infiltrated society. And they're causing the human race to just be this consumptive force where, you know, obey, procreate, consume, you know, eat, sleep, buy things, watch TV, et cetera, et cetera. But, of course, these aliens can only be seen through very special sunglasses that fall into the hands of a drifter played by Roddy Piper, his character's name is Nada. And along with a construction worker played by Keith David, Nada tries to make his stand in this dystopic view of the world, or this dystopic depiction of the 1980s. So first off, Rowdy Roddy Piper. I also want to note that he's going to be appearing in a movie from my worst list, which is an interesting distinction here. But I don't know. I don't want to say everything about They Live if it's your number one, Robin. Do you want to talk about it now, or do you want to save the real discussion for later?
Actually, I'll talk about it now and just put another movie in my number one slot when it comes to it. But yeah, They Live is definitely my favorite. I'm sure if you talk to most wrestling fans, they would all cite like They Live as their favorite movie ever starring a wrestler. I actually still remember when I started watching wrestling, Roddy Piper was like the shit. Like, he was amazing, and he actually retired like a year before the movie came out because he was pursuing a career in Hollywood, and everyone was kind of sad. But even though They Live became a cult hit, Roddy Piper did not really make that many good movies, so that's kind of why he kept retiring and unretiring several times. But I think it's cool that like apparently John Carpenter is like one of the world's biggest WWF fans, which is why he cast them. I used to hear that he would take plane trips to Toronto in the 1980s just to see their monthly wrestling shows at Maple Leaf Gardens. Like, that's how big a fan of it he is. And apparently he works very well with Roddy Piper, because apparently Piper, like, ad-libs some of his most memorable stuff. That very famous line about, I like to chew bubble gum and kick ass was apparently ad-libbed by Piper. And hasn't it been, like, ripped off? Is it, like, Duke Nukem?
Yeah, Duke Nukem says that.
I know a lot of people who think that the line originated from Duke Nukem, but it was totally thought up by Roddy Piper. And,
dude, for what it's worth, Duke Nukem also rips off a lot of lines from Army of Darkness.
Oh, okay, well, that explains it. But yeah, it's funny, like, this is a really, like, funny and satirical movie. Like, I really like the whole idea that of the sunglasses and how everyone's, like, aliens in disguise, and it throws in, like, a lot of cool satirical shots. Like, there's actually a shot at the end where you find out that the Siskel and Ebert-type critics who are criticizing, like, slasher movies from George Romero and John Carpenter are actually, like, aliens in disguise. And I know a lot of critics of this movie thinks this movie goes downhill at about the halfway point, and I'm sure everyone knows the scene I'm talking about where Nada and Frank get into an argument in an alley, and Nada wants him to try on the sunglasses, and Frank doesn't want to, and they get into, like, this 6-minute wrestling match that goes on and on and on, and apparently it wasn't supposed to be that long. The two actors, Roddy Piper and Keith David, totally choreographed it, and Carpenter is such a huge wrestling fan that he decided to use it. But it just goes past the point of ridiculous that it becomes hilarious. And some people think this is the movie's jump the shark moment, but I love the scene. I just, as a wrestling fan, I think the whole joke is just how long it goes and just how pointless the scene is, because they're really only fighting over a refusal to wear sunglasses. But even though the movie is ridiculous, it's consistently fun, and Roddy Piper is genuinely a good action hero in this. Like, he's obviously not a great actor, but he's got a lot of charisma, and he fits the part really well. And I kind of wish he had, like, a better career as a movie star, that he had become as successful as Dwayne The Rock Johnson, because he's terrific in this, and I still think it's a fairly underrated and underappreciated film. I know it's got a cult following, but it didn't get a lot of good reviews when it came out, but it's still one of my favorite John Carpenter films, and definitely my favorite film starring a wrestler.
You know, I had no idea that it actually didn't get very good reviews upon its initial release, because I love this movie. I totally think They Live it's just hilarious fun. It's got such a good campy premise, but, you know, for all that people may poo-poo this movie, it's actually been ripped off a bunch of times. Not just the lines from Roddy Piper in Duke Nukem, but also the whole premise of it was ripped off for a Simpsons video game. I can't remember what it was. I don't think it was... It wasn't Bart's Nightmare. There was a Simpsons video game. I know I had it for Sega Game Gear, where Bart had special sunglasses and you put them on and discover that people around you are aliens. So, I always assumed that it was this sort of pop culture influence. Weird that it didn't receive a good reception, but of course, it may have something to do with that extended fight scene in the middle. I personally love it as well, though, because it's sort of like a really obvious advertisement for Roddy Piper and wrestling. And even though John Carpenter hadn't scripted it or planned for it, it has this sort of old world feel, like you might see in an old movie where the star is like a gymnast, and so they have him gratuitously doing gymnastics or something like that. So that's why They Live is my number three, but I have two other interesting ones to talk about. Robin, what's your number two?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if this shows up as your number two as well, but I had to include it. I'm also going to include, like, a tie for it for totally different reasons, but it's George the Animal Steel playing Tor Johnson in Ed Wood. And as an honorable mention, I want to mention Tor Johnson himself playing the alien in Plan 9 for Outer Space, which are both two awesome performances for totally different reasons. Of course, Plan 9 from Outer Space is considered, like, one of the worst, like, films of all time, but it's definitely one of the most enjoyable bad movies of all time. Like, some bad movies you can watch and they're just unbearable and unwatchable, but Plan 9 is just so silly that it is fun to watch from beginning to end. And, of course, Tor Johnson was a very famous Swedish wrestler from that time period that Ed Wood saw and thought, this guy has to play the monster in a lot of my movies. And he was just so unqualified to be an actor. Like, his performance in Plan 9 from Outer Space and Bride of the Monster are just hilarious because he's just so uncoordinated, playing like a zombie and, like, completely bumping into sets and stuff. But that is part of his charm. And in Plan 9 from Outer Space, the poor guy, Ed Wood, gives him, like, this full page of dialogue in a cemetery scene where he's playing, like, a detective. But he's got this really thick Swedish accent, and he just looks so uncomfortable trying to, like, recite his dialogue, and it's just hilariously bad just the way he says lines like, "I will get one of the flashlights from patrol car," and stuff, and you almost feel good for him when he gets killed off and starts playing a zombie, because then he doesn't have to recite any lines of dialogue. But there is a charm to him, and I gotta say, Tor Johnson is one of my favorite bad actors of all time. He is a lot of fun to watch, because he didn't just work with Ed Wood. He did a lot of monster movies where he generally played, like, unkillable monsters. He was in a movie called The Beast of Yucca Flats, which is I watched on Mystery Science Theater and is completely unwatchable, but he's essentially playing the same type of role, and apparently his face became, like, a best-selling Halloween mask. So he's pretty much got a lasting pop culture legacy, I'll give him that.
That is my favorite piece of Tor Johnson trivia, too.
Yes.
He went on to become a best-selling Halloween mask, and he still is today.
He is, yeah. They mentioned that at the end of Ed Wood, and that's just so cool, because he has a really cool facial expression when he's playing the alien in Plan 9 from Outer Space. And, of course, the other one I'm talking about is George the Animal Steele in playing Tor Johnson in Tim Burton's Ed Wood, which I've talked about on plenty of other podcasts, but it's still my favorite, like, Tim Burton movie, because I just love Ed Wood movies and find his story completely fascinating. And it was just perfect casting, the role of George the Animal Steele. And I'm a huge fan of George Steele. I watched him growing up, and an article I wrote about wrestling at crack.com a few months ago, I told the story about how he was actually a gym teacher in Michigan named James Myers, and he's just a very intelligent, well-spoken guy, but during the summers, he would travel to New York and wrestle as George the Animal Steele, who was basically this Neanderthal character who could only speak in grunts and was a complete wild man, and everyone thought he was, like, insane, and then he would just go back to teach during the school year, and nobody would know they were the same guy. He would basically live an alter ego for something like 20 years, and no one knew that James Myers and George Steele were the same person. So he's a fascinating character, and he was well cast as Tor Johnson. He's a lot of fun in the role, and it's obviously the role wasn't a big stretch for him, but I was real fond of watching because I grew up being a big fan of the guy, and it was kind of cool to see him breaking character, like speaking like a normal guy in this movie, because he never broke character during his George Steele days. And yeah, that's why I put Ed Wood on the list. Even if you're not a wrestling fan, it's such a great movie overall that I highly recommend you check it out. And watch Plan 9 and Ed Wood back to back just to see the evolution from Tor Johnson to George the Animal Steele.
This is really funny. I almost had, as my number two, a tie between Ed Wood and Plan 9.
Oh, my God.
I almost did that exact same thing for the very same reasons, in fact. I didn't know that awesome piece of trivia about the double life led by George the Animal Steele, but I remember being a very big fan of his when I was a kid. I don't know. He's like the Incredible Hulk. I also really liked the Incredible Hulk when I was a kid. Just having this sort of barbaric, crazed, character in the wrestling circuit was awesome. I mean, of course, they're all these like big barbarians, and when they act like it, it's a fun part of their character because you can genuinely believe it. The Tor Johnson becoming a Halloween mask, I think that's absolutely hilarious as well. I really love that. You know, part of the reason Tor was so uncoordinated as a zombie is because he couldn't see through the contact lenses. I think that's hilarious. And then the scene where they're shooting that scene in the movie Ed Wood, and he can't get up out of the grave, and he's just fumbling around. It's all so funny. George the Animal Steele really does an amazing Tor Johnson. It is perfect casting, and quite kismetic in a way, having these big barbaric wrestlers playing the same, well, one playing a character and then the other playing that actor. Hilarious, just awesome meta moment. And I love both these movies for very different reasons. But I did not put them as my number two. My number two is Predator. So first, before we get into Predator, Jesse Ventura. I don't know a ton about Jesse Ventura as a wrestler. I remember he was among the collectibles that I played with as a kid, Jesse the Body Ventura, but he was never one of my favorites. And it wasn't until I think I was about 13 years old when I first saw The Predator that I was like, "Oh, Jesse Ventura, okay." And I don't know, he's not in the full movie. He dies pretty brutally in Predator, but he's definitely one of the most memorable characters and by far the most quotable in the whole film. Chewing this stuff will make you a goddamn sexual Tyrannosaurus, just like me. Did Predator make your list, Robin?
Actually, it didn't. It was close, but it didn't.
And what do you think of Jesse Ventura?
Well, I am a huge Jesse Ventura fan. Mostly his career, I grew up. By the time I started watching wrestling, he had to retire from in-ring competition because he got a blood clot in his lung. So it basically became like a commentator. But he was a really good commentator. Like, he was just a lot of fun to watch because of his very outspoken views. And he was like a heel, so he was always criticizing the good guys like Hulk Hogan and stuff. And I remember when I started watching wrestling, they were like plugging Predator like crazy. Where like they would show clips of it on the wrestling shows, like hyping up his role in it and stuff. And Jesse would always be going on and on how he was going to be like a bigger star than Arnold Schwarzenegger. And another movie, which is an honorable mention that he was in at the same time, was The Running Man with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where he played the role of Captain Freedom. So yeah, it's kind of funny how Predator is now the movie that's notable for having like two future governors in it. Two guys you would never ever visualize being governors, but who went on to have a successful career in the world of politics. And you're right, even though he's killed off early on, he does have like a very memorable role. Like the most famous line in the film is probably when he gets shot and they say, "You're hit, you're bleeding," and he goes, "I ain't got time to bleed," and stuff. Like, he's just such a badass, and it kind of establishes how deadly the Predator is, that he's able to kill off probably the most badass guy in the group, Blaine, like very quickly and stuff. But yeah, I've always been a big fan of Jesse Ventura. He's had a very interesting life, because he was a Navy SEAL before he got into wrestling, and then of course he went into politics and became a mayor and then a governor, and apparently he's always been wanting to run for president at some point, and now I think he hosts a TV show called Conspiracy Theory and stuff like that. So he's pretty much done it all, and he's done some fun movies, and he's done some terrible movies, which we may be mentioning later on, but Predator is definitely his best one.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, you know, I was aware of him as a wrestler, then I took note of him in Predator, and since taking note of him in Predator, I've become a really big fan of this guy's movie career particularly, and also some of his TV work, though I haven't seen a lot of his TV appearances, but I'm a big fan of the sort of culty movie, The Running Man, and he has a great role as Captain Freedom in that one. He is in Demolition Man, another great campy movie, and I believe I've talked about this on the podcast before, but he's in one of my favorite episodes of The X-Files, Jose Chung's From Outer Space as a Man in Black, and he gets such a great bit of dialogue here. Let me see. "No other object has been misidentified as a flying saucer more often than the planet Venus. Even the former leader of your United States of America, James Earl Carter Jr., thought he saw a UFO once, but it's been proven he only saw the planet Venus. Venus was at its peak brilliance last night. You probably thought you saw something up in the sky other than Venus, but I assure you, it was Venus." Amazing stuff, and he's such a character. I mean, I haven't seen his Conspiracy Theory show, and I hear that he comes off as, like, quite a nutball, which is perhaps to be expected from a guy with such a strange and varied career. And, I mean, heck, if you look at his film career, there are a lot of ups and downs just right there. But for all that he may be crazy, I certainly love his character. And I almost always enjoy the movies he's in. But again, probably for very different reasons, because some of them are really bad, but not entirely unenjoyable. So, Robin, do you have a number one to replace They Live?
Yes, I figured since he's the most successful wrestler turned actor that I should choose one film from Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And even though I'm a huge fan of The Rock, and I think he does well in most of the movies he stars in, I'm not a big fan of a lot of his movies. And I think it's just because it's a lot of the projects he chooses, like The Tooth Fairy. Like, I have zero interest in seeing something like that at all. So I think in his career he has done more misses than hits, but my favorite of his is probably The Rundown. And this is around the time when he was finally, like, transitioning, like, full time from like wrestling to movies. Like he did the cameo in The Mummy Returns, and then he starred in The Scorpion King. And this is around the time when people realized, hey, he's serious. He could become like a full time movie star out of this. And he eventually pretty much left pro wrestling for a couple years after The Rundown came out. And this movie is a lot of fun. Like it's no great shakes. It's pretty much like a formulaic like buddy action comedy, but it is a very entertaining one, and I think The Rock has very good chemistry with Sean William Scott, and I like the setting down there in the jungles of Brazil, and it's elevated a lot by the presence of Christopher Walken, of course, as the villain, and it's just one of those performances where you just kind of sense that Walken is like pretty much ad-libbing most of his lines on the spot, just because most of them don't make any sense, but he is a lot of fun, and I particularly love the opening scene of this film where The Rock is walking into a nightclub, and then he passes by Arnold Schwarzenegger in a cameo saying, "Good luck," which is pretty much him trying to pass the torch almost, because he had just become governor at the time, and he's kind of saying to The Rock, "You're going to be the next action star in it." And the action scenes in this are well done. The Rock shows a lot of charisma, and I like the shootout at the end where his character Beck is a guy who just hates guns and stuff and refuses to use them. So you just know it's going to be predictable that he's going to pull out a gun in the big fight, in the big climactic scene. But they shoot that moment really well, and it works effectively. And surprisingly, this wasn't one of his biggest hits. It did all right, but it wasn't a smash. But it's kind of ironic because it's probably The Rock's best starring vehicle and one that sent him on the road to a big career in Hollywood. And that's why he's still a movie star today. So this movie was definitely a big turning point in his career.
I actually had the same quandary as you. I really wanted to put a movie starring The Rock on my top three, but most of his movies just aren't aren't good enough for me to be like, yeah, this is the number one. And like you, The Rundown is probably my favorite. I actually saw this in theaters. I've always thought that The Rock has the kind of charisma that could actually really turn him into this big action star, and it seems like recently with his appearances in the Fast and Furious movies, and also him starring in G.I. Joe, like it might finally be sort of cementing him as this action hero for to replace all the old guys who basically are the cast of The Expendables. Yeah, Christopher Walken is great in this one. I only saw it the once, but I remember it having a lot of really fun action. And he and Sean William Scott, you know, they had decent buddy chemistry. I also remember there being a reasonably amusing sequence where they all get high off some strange fruit that they eat. This is one that I'd sort of recommend offhandedly if you're looking for a fun action movie. It's certainly one that I wouldn't mind revisiting at some point. And my number one, Robin, you predicted this one as soon as we started talking about this, discussing this topic on the podcast, but I had to dip into my pantheon here. I really try to keep this movie off my lists because it falls into so many different categories. You could, you know, have listed as having the best fight scene or the best love story or the best cameo from a comedian or even the best casting of a wrestler. The movie is The Princess Bride, and of course the wrestler is Andre the Giant as Fezzik. Now, the role of Fezzik was written with Andre the Giant in mind, which is really interesting because when I say that, I mean the book upon which the movie The Princess Bride is based. Robin, have you had a chance to read the book The Princess Bride by William Goldman?
Actually, no, I have never read it.
It's a really terrific book, and it's funny, you know, we were talking about John dies at the end earlier, and these books that have unique narrative voices that work on the page but not necessarily on the screen. The Princess Bride is one of those rare anomalies where the book is isn't actually the complete story of The Princess Bride. It's a story within a story, very much like the movie is. The book is broken up by these sections where the person it's all done as a sort of a hoax. The book is purported to be the manuscript of the novel The Princess Bride by the fictional author S. Morgan Stern that was lost to the sands of time, and then a manuscript was found by William Goldman, and that's what you're reading in the book of The Princess Bride. And it's with Goldman's notes saying, I remember when I was sick, my grandfather would come over and read me the book. And then, you know, when there was a kissing part, the story would cut away and there'd be notes from Goldman again saying, we always skip this part because as a kid I thought it was kind of gross and we wanted to keep it moving along. And then, you know, and so on and so forth. And they actually managed to translate that really well, The Princess Bride, in adapting it to the screen by having that framing narrative. Anyway, bringing it back to Andre the Giant, when Goldman notes in the, he has sort of like the special author's, you know, director's cut of The Princess Bride, which I own, and he notes in his, I think it's in his introduction, that when he was writing the book, he wrote Fezzik with Andre the Giant in mind, like just as a, you know, he saw Andre the Giant and thought, you know, this is the giant that I'm going to put in my fantasy story. And then when it came time to cast the movie, they actually managed to get Andre the Giant, but Andre the Giant was, he was really nervous about acting. He had this very thick accent, and it was really difficult for him to speak English and have it be easily understood. And there's a great story on the commentary of the DVD for The Princess Bride about how he and Mandy Patinkin were running their lines in a script read-through, and Andre was just going too slow, and Mandy Patinkin turned around and slapped him and said, faster, Fezzik, quickly, because it was an urgent scene. And that actually managed to spur Andre into saying his lines quicker. But at this point in Andre the Giant's career, I believe he'd retired from wrestling because his back was starting to give out under his tremendous size. And so for a lot of the scenes, particularly the one where he catches Buttercup, Robin Wright's character, you know, jumps out of the window and he catches her. For that, they had to have her on a harness and they had to have like a mat ready because it was so painful for him to stand up and walk around and to catch her. They also talk about how they had to, he had to be moved around on his own little cart because his back was in such pain at this point. But, it really is just sort of like the stars aligned perfectly, where the character of Fezzik was written with Andre the Giant in mind, but not for him. And then eventually, when it was adapted into a movie, the role really was for him, and he's perfect in it. He gives such a great performance too, as the sort of innocent, naive, simple-minded Fezzik, who, you know, he's hired just because he's so big that he can crush people so easily and just intimidate everybody, but he's actually really kind-hearted and very sweet, and all of that comes through. And if you watch the making of The Princess Bride, they have this whole retrospective about Andre the Giant, because of course he's dead now, and it'll, you know, watch out, have the Kleenex ready, because it's just so sweet and so sad. They talk about how he was so happy to be there every day, and how he, when asked about what his favorite thing about working on the movie was, he said, nobody looks at me funny. You know, it's like he's supposed to be there. So, yeah, I cheated. I know. It's from my pantheon. Robin, do you have anything to add about Andre the Giant?
Yeah, I actually still remember the time period when that movie came out. That's about the time I started watching wrestling. And it's always fascinating to think when these wrestlers did these big movies, the storylines they would come up to let them take time off for a couple months so they could go film it. And I remember that Andre the Giant got suspended for a couple months so he could take time off to film The Princess Bride. And when he came back, he was a bad guy, and he had like that huge match at WrestleMania 3 with Hulk Hogan. He wasn't quite retired at the time he made it, but he was close to it because he had all these back problems and stuff. So, but yeah, it was such a good vehicle for him. And I thought it was so cool that like William Goldman, like when he wrote the novel, he couldn't picture anybody else but Andre in it, because apparently he used to watch him wrestle at like Madison Square Garden all the time. And when the movie came about, he was actually able to get him. And I think he even said that, I don't think the character of Fezzik would have worked with anybody else. And it is kind of cool that like Andre didn't have any acting experience, and because of his thick French accent he wasn't comfortable speaking, but they still cast him anyway because he was so perfect for that part. And he is. And it's kind of cool just because people who don't know anything about wrestling still know who Andre the Giant is. And it's because of his role in that movie, because it's such a beloved, iconic movie. It's such an all-time classic. So yeah, I knew it was going to be on your list, and it came close to being on my list, but I just, since I knew you were going to pick it, I left it off. But yeah, it's definitely one of the all-time greats.
Yeah, absolutely terrific. It's a movie that has everything. And if you haven't seen The Princess Bride, come on now, waste no time, seek it out. And yeah, watch, in my opinion, the greatest performance from a wrestler in any movie. So before we get to the worst, before we descend to the other end of the spectrum, do you have any honorable mentions, Robin? I know I have a bunch.
Yeah, I have a couple. One we need to mention is Monster Brawl, which we saw at Fantasia Fest last year, which is basically nothing but wrestlers fighting each other and monsters and stuff. A lot of greats have cameos in it, like Kevin Nash and the Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart, and Robert Millay, who played the role of Kurgan in the WWF and also had a prominent role in the Sherlock Holmes movie. And we even got an email from the director of that film when we talked about it on a podcast after we'd seen it. So big thumbs up for Monster Brawl as well.
Absolutely, yeah, we all got to shake Kurgan's hand.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. And another one from The Rock that I actually like is Get Smart, which I thought was kind of a very enjoyable film. And it also has a very prominent role for the great Kali, the 7-foot Hindu wrestler from WWE. He has a role as a henchman in the film, so that's a good showcase for good wrestling roles. Also, the movie Warrior, which I was championing when it came out in 2011, it actually has a good role for Kurt Angle playing the big Russian guy that Tom Hardy winds up fighting in like the big climax and stuff. And it's kind of funny that Kurt Angle won an Olympic gold medal for America in like the 1996 Olympics in amateur wrestling, and here he was playing like this big badass Russian, which I thought was kind of ironic, but that's a good role for him as well. Also, Man on the Moon, it also has a lot of prominent wrestling personalities in it as well, most especially Jerry the King Lawler playing himself in his legendary feud with Andy Kaufman. And I'm a big fan of like Memphis wrestling from the 1980s, so it was a great nostalgia trick seeing them recreate that era of wrestling. I thought that was pretty cool as well. Also, another John Carpenter one that people forget is Escape from New York. The wrestler with the big mustache that Snake Plissken fights during that in New York is actually Ox Baker, who was a very like prominent professional wrestler. So John Carpenter, of course, decided to cast him, but apparently he was like really bad at following direction and memorizing his lines. So Carpenter almost regretted like casting him in the role, but he did it just because he was a big fan of him. And also, the movie Roadhouse actually it's kind of a guilty pleasure of mine, actually has a prominent role for the wrestler Terry Funk. He plays the role of Morgan, the bouncer that Patrick Swayze fires from the club and winds up kicking his ass at the end. I'm a big Terry Funk fan. I even owned an autographed book from him, so it was cool to see him playing a role and fighting Patrick Swayze. Also got to give a shout-out to the Macho Man Randy Savage for his role as Boomsaw in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man. It's one of those roles that wrestlers are in where even if you don't know much about wrestling, they know who the Macho Man is just because he was in Spider-Man. So that was a great showcase for him. And yeah, that's about all the good ones I can really think of it. I guess I should mention Professor Toru Tanaka, who is a very prominent wrestler. He also can be seen in a lot of famous films from like the 1980s. He also has a role as Sub-Zero in The Running Man, and he had a role in Pee-wee's Big Adventure as well. And he pops up in pretty much every action film that was released during the 1980s. So he's another very successful wrestler turned actor.
Like I said before, you know, we're drawing a lot from the same pool because you've already gone through most of my honorable mentions: Spider-Man, Escape from New York, Monster Brawl, Man on the Moon, and of course, this is where I also had the Rundown and the Godfather listed. I did want to say that even though I didn't put any of these movies on my list, and they're not really, you know, wrestlers, I guess one of them is wrestler starring roles for The Rock. I did want to take note of Southland Tales, because that's a really interesting role for Dwayne Johnson. He puts in a really great performance, even though the movie is just totally ass-backwards weird. And also, Be Cool. He plays a really good role in the movie Be Cool, even though I'm not a big fan of the movie Be Cool. A couple of other ones that you didn't mention, though. X-Men. Is it Kevin Nash in X-Men?
Oh, Tyler Mayne.
Tyler Mayne, that's right.
He didn't have a really distinguished wrestling career. I think it was very brief, so he had much more success as an actor.
Oh, fair enough. That I didn't know. And also, Stone Cold Steve Austin, I believe, was in The Expendables 2, so we might as well mention that. So,
I forgot to mention a Hulk Hogan one, but the best Hulk Hogan role is probably playing Thunderlips in Rocky III, which has pretty much kind of propelled him to stardom. So even though most of Hogan's movies are terrible, that's still a very memorable role.
Yeah, it's pretty funny to think that of all the I'm going to go out on a limb and say of all the wrestlers who have attempted to have acting careers, Hulk Hogan is probably the most prolific. Like, he's probably done the most movies, but I think it's also quite telling that not a single damn one of them wound up in our best lists or honorable mentions. And with that,
mention is also Harold Sakata, who played the role of Oddjob in Goldfinger. He was also a very successful professional wrestler as well.
Oh, was he? That I didn't know.
Yeah, well, he wrestled under the name Tosh Togo, I think.
Oh, well, you gotta love Oddjob.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the worst wrestling movie, or the worst movie starring wrestlers, not the worst wrestling movies. I'll admit, I didn't put mine in any particular order, but Robin, what was your number three worst?
I had to pick one movie from WWE Studios because ever since several years ago, WWE has opened up their own films division where they get some of their wrestlers to star in movies. And most of the time, they're pretty terrible. And I also have to sit and see them get plugged nonstop on their wrestling programs and then pretend it's like some of the greatest movies of all time. And it gets really nauseating. But, I think the worst one is actually The Marine 2. Now, the first Marine, it was a pretty terrible action movie on its own. It starred John Cena, but at least he's like the number one star in the company, so I can kind of understand why they made it. And most of the films they made at least star their like big superstars who are very well known. The Marine 2 stars Ted DiBiase Jr. Gil, I know you're probably familiar with the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, from the 1980s. Well, he has a son, Ted DiBiase Jr., who's gone into wrestling, and pretty much the only reason he's been able to make it in the WWE is because he's the Million Dollar Man's son, because he is, like, just a black full of charisma. Like, he is just one of the most boring wrestlers I'd ever seen. Like, he's a decent enough athlete, but he just doesn't have any personality whatsoever, and he's obviously only has a job because of his father. And for whatever reason, they thought it would be a good idea to have him star in his own action movie, a sequel to a film that wasn't any good in the first place. So seeing Ted DiBiase Jr. trying to act and carry his own movie is not a pretty sight. As an action film, it's pretty generic and forgettable overall. I mean, there's nothing, like, overly bad about it, but it just has the most uncharismatic, like, leading man you can imagine. He just looks so bored in it, and he looks so bored during his fight scenes, too. So I don't know why they thought it would be a good idea to cast him. And the sad thing is this movie actually has some decent actors in it. It's got Tamara Morrison, and it's got Michael Rooker from The Walking Dead. And once you see Ted DiBiase acting alongside him, you realize what a lightweight he is. It's kind of a shame, too, because I was a huge fan of the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, and I would have loved to seen him, like, headline his own movies. But unfortunately, his son got to do it, and, one of the worst action stars ever.
Oh, dear. I'm glad that I skipped those. Because I'm not a wrestling fan, I really had no reason to watch The Marine or The Marine 2. Whew! Dodged a bullet.
Yes. But you are familiar with Ted DiBiase, right? The original?
Oh, yes, of course. The Million Dollar Man. I believe I had, like, a trading card of him stashed in my collection of wrestling stuff. Wonder where that all wound up. Probably in garage sales.
Yeah.
So my number three, I'm going to go with, I already spoke about Jesse Ventura. Well, here's the other end of the spectrum, but it's only at my number three because I kind of enjoy this one. It's one of those so bad it's good movies. The film is Abraxas, Guardian of the Universe.
I knew it.
So the plot is Abraxas is like an alien cop, and he lands on Earth to apprehend a renegade alien who impregnates a woman with an alien, a mutant embryo. Jesse Ventura plays Abraxas, the good alien cop, and Svenoli Thorsson plays the bad alien cop. And for a second there, while I was compiling my list, I thought, isn't Svenoli Thorsson a wrestler? But no, he was just a bodybuilder and a karate black belt. This movie is hilarious. I mean, it's just as cheesy as the title implies and the plot description as well. Jesse Ventura he's still a ridiculous character. He's kind of a ridiculous character in everything he does, even when he's playing the cool Blaine from Predator. But here, I don't know, it's just so silly. Everything about this movie is so silly. There are a lot of strange lines that are thrown in there, too. For example, there's an exchange between the father and mother. Abraxas befriends this little boy along the way, and here's an exchange from the boy's father and mother. Father says, "So what makes you think you can locate my 4x4? And Braxton says, "My box has VD. Trust me." The mother says, "You're what?" "VD. Vibrational detection." What? it's so ridiculous. It's funny. A lot of movies that follow this same plot line end up being guilty pleasure movies of mine. I don't know what it is, but they always end up being like really dumb and really bad, but at the same time, really kind of fun and enjoyable. Another great example is The Hidden, and the movie I Come in Peace just follows this exact same plot, except with Dolph Lundgren thrown into the middle instead of a small boy. Robin, have you had the pleasure of seeing Abraxas, Guardian of the Universe?
Oh, quite a few times, actually. I agree with you. This is a terrible movie, but it is terrible in an enjoyable way, just about how ridiculous it is, because another favorite scene of mine, isn't there a scene where he's, like, talking to the boy while he's in bed, and he's giving this speech about, "There was a man who liked a boy," or something like that. Do you remember that scene?
Yes, there is a really awkwardly, there's an awkward scene where Abraxas is sitting in his bed and the little boy comes and hangs out with him, and it creates a very strange sort of homoerotic tension. Right from the beginning, the boy pops his head in the doorway of Abraxas' bedroom, and Abraxas looks over and goes, "Hello." it's really ridiculous. And I'd be very interested. Do you know if this one's come out on DVD with a commentary? Because I'd kind of be interested to hear the background on this utterly insane movie. It is a perfect sort of movie to get together with a bunch of friends and watch, you know?
Actually, I think it's in the public domain now. I've seen it in those, like, bargain bin sets, like, bundled together with other movies, so I highly doubt that there are any commentary tracks for it. But the movie is pretty ridiculous, and a friend of my brother's actually went to the premiere of that film because it was filmed, I think, in somewhere like Thornbury, Ontario, and he lived in the area, and he went there, and apparently Svenoli Thorsson was there, but Jesse Ventura was not. He did not want to show up to it. But even though he's a very charismatic guy, he's very awkward and stiff in this movie, and Svenoli Thorsson, he's been in a ton of action movies, and he usually plays a silent henchman, but this one, they give him, like, way too much dialogue. He's almost like poor Tor Johnson, where he's got this thick Swedish accent, but they give him way too much dialogue, even though he sounds very awkward and uncomfortable reciting it. And another funny scene is because it stars Jim Belushi's wife in it. She's the leading lady. Jim Belushi makes a very random cameo as a school principal in one scene. He pops up and, like, is never seen again. It's just very bizarre. But
even though that's why he's in this movie. I had no idea.
Yeah, I couldn't figure it out at first, but then I looked up that, oh, yeah, that was his wife in the lead role, so that kind of makes more sense now. But yeah, even though this is a terrible movie, I would recommend bad movie fans check it out, because it's not boring. It does have a lot of entertainment value.
What's your number two?
My number two, I had to go with a Hulk Hogan movie, and the runaway choice for worst movie he did was the infamous Santa with Muscles, which is one of the worst Christmas movies of all time. I believe I put it on my worst Christmas movies list that I posted at the back row. This has one of the dumbest storylines that I've ever heard of, where basically Hulk Hogan plays this rich asshole who is being chased around by the police, and he ducks into a mall and disguises himself in a Santa suit to hide from the police. But then he winds up receiving a bump on the head, and it gives him amnesia. And because he is wearing a Santa suit, he winds up being convinced that he is the real Santa Claus. And then he winds up at an orphanage that is being threatened to be shut down, and he winds up befriending all these kids who also believe that he's the real Santa Claus. And this has one of the most embarrassing Before They Were Stars moments, because a young 12-year-old Mila Kunis plays the role of one of the kids in this, one of her most embarrassing acting jobs. And it even gets more ridiculous, because I think it's Ed Begley Jr. plays a mad scientist who finds out that there are crystals buried underneath the orphanage. So he wants to tear down the orphanage to get all these powerful crystals to, like, rule the world or something like that. And the Hulkster has to stop him. And it gets even more bizarre, because the former wrestler Brutus the Barber Beefcake, who is also Hulk Hogan's best friend in real life, plays the role of an Oriental mad scientist. And even though Brutus Beefcake is not Oriental, they actually give him a eyebrows and a Fu Manchu mustache. It's just a very bizarre, offensive stereotype. But I'm sure I don't even have to describe how bad this movie is. Just listening to the plot summary, I'm sure you can get an idea of just how terrible it is. This is pretty much Hulk Hogan when his movies weren't even getting released in theaters anymore. They were just going straight to video just because of how horrible it is. I think it wasn't long after this that he did the Three Ninjas High Noon at Mega Mountain, which we talked about on a previous podcast. But this pretty much signaled the end of Hulk Hogan's attempts to become a full-fledged movie star. He had really hit the bottom of the barrel, and I don't know who this movie is supposed to appeal to, because it's too bizarre to appeal to kids, but it's just so insulting that I don't see any adult possibly enjoying this. And so even though there's some tough competition, this is definitely Hulk Hogan's worst film.
Have you actually sat through that movie?
I had to. That's how devoted I am to watching bad movies with wrestlers.
Wow, man. Yeah, you know, I was racking my brain for a good Hulk Hogan entry to put here. I didn't want to do Three Ninjas High Noon at Mega Mountain, because we already talked about just how terrible that movie is. But the one I was going to pick was Suburban Commando, because I actually saw it when I was a kid. And this is another one where it's just totally bizarre. And yet another movie where it's an alien versus alien on planet Earth with a suburban family caught in the middle of it. Weird, man.
But it has become a popular internet meme because of Christopher Lloyd's line, "I was frozen today."
Yeah, the Nostalgia Critic has certainly helped that along.
It's also worthwhile too, because The Undertaker has a role as a bounty hunter sent after Hulk Hogan, and the Undertaker never acts in movies, so it's kind of bizarre seeing him out of character playing. And they have like a gag where he doesn't speak until the very end, and when he speaks, he's got the voice of a little girl. It's very bizarre.
Yeah, totally strange. But as far as the Hulk Hogan movies go, that was the one. I think that's one of the few that I've watched all the way through. I think other than that, maybe at some point I saw Mr. Nanny, but I certainly don't remember it at all.
It's terrible as well.
So, my number two, this is going to be I mentioned Rowdy Roddy Piper, and I said he'd appear down here as well. Hell Comes to Frogtown. And you saw this one, like, not that long ago. Is that right, Rob?
Yeah, I think you'd lend it to me. I think you were shocked or something that I hadn't ever seen this movie before, knowing what a big Piper fan I am.
Yeah, that's right. I had gotten it from Netflix back when I bothered taking out DVDs from Netflix. This is a weird sci-fi sex comedy. It's a sex comedy that it really doesn't have a lot of sex front and center. It's more just the implication of sex. So it's a movie in a distant post-apocalyptic future where Rowdy Roddy Piper plays the character Sam Hell, and he's taken prisoner by these women who run the USA after a nuclear war. So there are mutants everywhere, and he is tasked with helping them rescue a group of fertile women so that they can procreate, and the women are being held by these frog-like mutants. And as incentive to help them, the women strap a bomb to Sam Hell's crotch. This is a really absurd movie. It plays like I feel like I should refer to it as like a porn parody, because that's the kind of sort of raunchiness that this movie has, but it's really not a porno. It's really not sexy in any way or anything like that, but it's like an adult raunchy sci-fi comedy. And I don't know, it's so bizarre. It's not very good, but much like Abraxas, it's the kind of movie where if you watch it with a bunch of friends, you're all fans of bad movies, you could actually take some pleasure from this. Apparently there was a sequel, Return to Frog Town, that I have not had the pleasure of seeing, but it doesn't have Rowdy Roddy Piper in it. Do you have any thoughts on Helicopter Frog Town? It's one of those movies where it's like, yeah, it's really bad. He's got a bomb on his nuts. There are some dumb sci-fi costumes, and that's about it.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up, because just listening to the plot summary, you think this would be a more entertaining movie, because you know it would be bad, but you think it would be at least more enjoyably bad. This one wasn't particularly memorable. It's like the execution was really off. Like, I seem to remember that there were quite a few dead spots in this. Like, there were some entertaining parts, and Rowdy Roddy Piper was fun in the lead role, but I think there were a lot of scenes of just people going around barren desert wastelands wearing silly futuristic costumes where nothing was really happening. So the whole bomb strapped to his crotch and the fact that he has to keep the human race going by impregnating women is a pretty funny idea for a campy film, but this is just one of those bad movies that's just kind of plain bad but not entertaining bad, unfortunately.
Robin, what's your number one?
My number one, it's not a movie where the wrestlers are the stars, but it is about wrestling, and it features a lot of prominent wrestling, and it's absolutely awful, and that's Ready to Rumble, the wrestling movie starring David Arquette. Up until The Wrestler came out a couple years ago, pro wrestling fans were always angry because there really wasn't any good fictional films about wrestling. Like, there are a lot of good documentaries about it and a lot of good movies starring wrestlings, but it seems that when movies would try to cover the subject of pro wrestling, they would totally drop the ball. And this one is just a colossal clusterfuck. It is just I don't know who it was supposed to appeal to, because it makes pro wrestling look really dumb, and it also alienates, like, wrestling fans. So I don't know who exactly was supposed to like this movie, because basically the two main characters played by David Arquette and Scott Kahn, they're like sewage workers, and they're the biggest wrestling fans, but they're so dumb that they think wrestling is 100% real, and their hearts are broken when they find out that wrestling is fake and stuff. And all I could think of is, like, what wrestling fan watching this would like this, because it's basically making all wrestling fans look like complete idiots and stuff. So right away, you're just alienating your core fan base. And basically anyone who's not a wrestling fan would not have any interest in seeing this whatsoever, because that's all it covers. It has like a lot of like big name wrestlers like Diamond Dallas Page and Goldberg and Sting. It was produced by World Championship Wrestling at the time, WCW, and they made one of the most boneheaded PR moves of all time, where they basically did a storyline where David Arquette literally won the WCW heavyweight title, and they thought it would get a lot of mainstream publicity and stuff, but problem is that David Arquette, he's not an A-list celebrity, so no one really cared, and WCW wound up bombing so horribly after this came out that they wound up going out of business and being bought out by Vince McMahon like a year later. Like, that's how bad Ready to Rumble was, that it nearly like it nearly caused an entire wrestling company to go out of business. But the movie as a comedy, it just isn't funny at all. It's got a lot of like really lowbrow humor. Like, I think a movie that actually took a real comedic behind the scenes look at professional wrestling, what it's really like, would be a really great movie, but this movie, it bears no resemblance whatsoever to the real world of professional wrestling. And it has a surprisingly good cast. I don't know why they have started it. Like, Joe Pantoliano's in it, Martin Landau is in it for whatever reason, Rose McGowan's in it, and for whatever reason they cast Oliver Platt as this big wrestling star. Like, Oliver Platt is a good actor, but casting him as a professional wrestler is probably one of the worst casting choices I've ever seen. He is just not convincing and believable at all as a wrestler. He's this big, out of shape, uncharismatic guy. He's just, I don't know why they thought Oliver Platt as a wrestler was a good idea, but the movie is a disaster, like, at every aspect. Like, if you're not a wrestling fan, you might just write this off as just a dumb, forgettable comedy. But if you are a wrestling fan, this movie is just an insult to your intelligence and will make you angry. So that's why I put it as my number one spot.
I'm glad I've never seen that one. Yeah. I did hear it was pretty terrible. I find myself kind of stumbling here because I'm just now realizing that I made a mistake in my original number one. They were bodybuilders, but they weren't actually wrestlers. I assumed that they were wrestlers. So instead of, I'll give a mention to it. I was going to put the movie Twin Sitters here, starring the Barbarian Twins. And I thought because of their name that they were actually wrestlers, but they were just bodybuilders.
I never actually heard of that one, actually.
Oh my God, it's so terrible. I mean, it really is just about these two enormous beefy guys who are tasked with babysitting these kids, and the kids get kidnapped and held hostage.
Oh my God.
And it's a family comedy, and it's bad. And I thought they were wrestlers, I swear, but alas, they are not. So instead, I'm going to throw in, I haven't seen any one of these movies all the way through, but to me, they are all equally shameful. And those are The Game Plan and Tooth Fairy, both starring The Rock. It's, you know, I feel like it took Arnold Schwarzenegger a while to get to the point in his career where he started doing dumb family comedies. And it took Dwayne The Rock Johnson much less time to get into those family comedies. It happened. Oh, yeah, and Journey to the Center of the Earth Part 2. I'll just chuck in there as well. And Escape to Witch Mountain. These are all just such sort of bland, I don't know, bland movies. Does anybody fondly remember that many of Arnold's, like, kid-friendly stuff? Like, is anybody opining for Arnold to do more roles like he did in Around the World in 80 Days or, or Junior or any of those? I just think it's a real shame that The Rock started doing that stuff so soon. And now it's like he has to sort of recover by doing more action movies after he went through that slump. Robin, have you seen any of those movies that I mentioned?
I did watch The Game Plan just because of The Rock, and this was a movie where I thought he was enjoyable in it. He had a lot of charisma, but just the project was so unworthy of him because it was just so bland and cutesy and stuff. And I guess it was a success because he's made like a lot of these type of movies. While watching it, I'm thinking his charisma was carrying it only so far, but just like the project itself was just so lame. And it's kind of a shame because like just watching his wrestling career, he is just such a charismatic guy that it's like it's too bad that most of the projects he selects to do are just unworthy of his talents.
Yeah, it's true. Hopefully we will see more of him. Yeah, and I again, you know, I mentioned it in my honorable mentions, but in my dishonorable mentions as well, I just want to mention Southland Tales, because that movie is such a mess, but The Rock gives this, like, oddly sort of fun and charming performance in it. Have you had a chance to see that one, Robin?
Yeah, I've never been a fan of it all. It just went completely over my head. So I know some people. Isn't Tom Lando a huge Southland Tales fan?
Oh, yeah, he loves this movie.
Yeah, I just could not get into it at all. But I guess The Rock was decent in it.
And I think that draws our conversation about the best and worst films starring wrestlers to a close. But do you have, as a wrap-up, is there anything else that you have to say about wrestlers turned actors, Robin? Do you find that they are generally less successful, more often than not, they are not successful?
Yeah, that's true. Like, The Rock was kind of the exception. But guys like Hulk Hogan and Roddy Piper, they may have a few hits, but they wind up not really making a career out of it, and they wind up having to go back to wrestling, unfortunately. I think it turns out better if you give wrestlers, like, supporting roles, like Andre the Giant and George the Animal Steel did, because, they're very good at their roles as wrestlers, but a lot of them really don't have the moxie, I think, to carry an entire movie, unfortunately. But before I wrap it up, I just want to give an honorable mention to Tom Tiny Lister Jr., who has the weird arc of starting out as a actor, becoming a wrestler, and then becoming a successful actor again. He started the movie No Holds Barred with Hulk Hogan back in, like, 1989, which I actually went to see in a theater. He played the role of Zeus, Hogan's enemy, and they actually decided to bring him into the WWF. And pretend that his character Zeus was real, and he actually got into some matches with, like, Hulk Hogan, and he was pretty awful as a wrestler, and it was a complete disaster. But what's funny is Tiny Lister actually went on to have a successful acting career after leaving wrestling. He starred in the Friday movies, and he had prominent roles in, like, The Fifth Element and Jackie Brown, and he had a very memorable bit part in The Dark Knight, where he plays the convict on the boat who throws the detonator out of the window. So he's got a huge list of credits. He's done very well for himself, so it's kind of funny that he went from being a unsuccessful actor to being an unsuccessful wrestler to being a successful actor again.
I had no idea. That is really funny. But yeah, I've definitely taken note of Tiny Lister and his roles, particularly The Dark Knight and The Fifth Element. Are you looking forward to the new G.I. Joe? Are there any upcoming wrestler movies that you want to see?
Not really, no. What's funny is that the movie Dead Man Down that came out in theaters this past weekend, a wrestler named Wade Barrett from WWE actually had a prominent role in it, because whenever wrestlers appear in, like, a big mainstream film, they pimp the hell out of it on WWE TV. But unfortunately, most of the movie's starred wrestlers are usually produced by WWE Studios, and there's one, they're actually making The Marine Part 3, which is coming out very soon, starring a wrestler named The Miz, and I do not think it bodes well at all. So I am kind of looking forward to G.I. Joe, the sequel, but it got delayed several months, and that's never a good sign. And like I've said before, if they had released these G.I. Joe movies out like 20 years ago and maybe put Sergeant Slaughter in them, I'd be excited about them. But nowadays, I'm just kind of lukewarm to it. But I probably will go see the new G.I. Joe movie anyway.
I have similar opinions on that one. It'll probably be fun. The first Steven Summers G.I. Joe was kind of a guilty pleasure of mine, so hopefully this one will be good. I guess The Rock is also appearing in the next Fast and Furious movie too. And I think that just about does it, which means it's time for the dumb joke of the week. And I got a bunch of dumb jokes, but I wanted to see if I could find a wrestler one, and I couldn't really. Do you know any wrestler jokes or wrestling jokes, Robin?
Not off the top of my head. Unfortunately.
I found a few lists, but I don't, because I'm not a wrestling fan, I don't really get any of the references, so I don't know if they're funny or not. So instead, I'll just tell a lame one. Why did the Scarecrow win the Nobel Prize? He was outstanding in his field. If you want to get in touch with us,
tie-in, so that's a good one.
Yeah, exactly. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so by email. Send Robin a message. Write to Robin about wrestling at robin.warder@the-back-row.com. And be sure to check out Robin's regular features, Robin's Underrated Gems, Before They Were Stars. And keep an eye out on cracked.com for Robin's articles. You can already read a number of them there.
Including a wrestling one, 5 Insane True Tales of Wrestlers Refusing to Break Character.
There you have it. And I write every day on the back row. You can reach me by emailing gil@the-back-row.com. Thanks so much for listening. I ain't got time to bleed. Music for today's podcast comes to us courtesy of Vince Nitro. Feel free to email Vince at vincenitro@the-back-row.com.